Hello and welcome to Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo. I'm Ryan Bickle. On today's show, we have Beth Armstrong, who is the founder of the ZAC Conference, and we'll learn more about what ZAC Conference is and everything that she has done for conservation. But first, I'm going to introduce Jessie Lowry, and she's going to start off our show today.
Thanks, Ryan. I'm Jessie Lowry, the Director of Conservation and Research here at Blank Park Zoo. And I always like to take the first couple minutes and kind of set the stage and talk about the role of a modern zoo, like Blank Park Zoo, in saving animals in the wild. The mission of Blank Park Zoo is to inspire an appreciation of the natural world through conservation, education, research, and recreation. But I really see Blank Park Zoo and other accredited zoos as windows to the wild, a place where we can invite the community and schools and families to come into the zoo and see a glimpse of the beauty that nature has to offer, to see the amazing agility of sea lions and to see the beautiful lions in the snow in the wintertime right now, and feel that sense of awe that we all feel when we see these amazing creatures. But it's our job as a zoo to turn that warm, fuzzy feeling into a real conservation action, something that's going to make a difference to wildlife populations and the environment from every corner of the earth. And so Blank Park Zoo does conservation in many ways. We work to be as sustainable as possible in our day-to-day business operations because we know that what we consume and the products that we use has a direct impact on wildlife, especially single-use plastics. So we're trying to get better at that and encourage our audience to do so as well. We are trying to be a leader in local conservation, working to encourage people to plant butterfly gardens, encouraging hunters to use non-lead ammunition, all of these easy conservation actions that we can do to make sure that Iowa really conserves its natural resources. But one of the, you know, the backbone, I think, of what a zoo can do to save animals in the wild is to support financially, you know, those field organizations, those people and organizations that are out on the front lines in the range countries of the animals that we have here at the zoo. And some animals that we don't have here at the zoo, like chimpanzees, we support the Chimpanzee Sanctuary and Wildlife Conservation Trust in Uganda. We support the International Rhino Foundation in Africa and Asia, the Giraffe Conservation Foundation in Namibia, Hornbill Research Foundation in Thailand, all of these amazing heroes out on the front lines of conservation around the world. And the important part here is that the way that we fund these projects is a portion of every dollar that we make here at Blank Park Zoo goes to these projects. So it means that just by visiting the zoo, you're helping to save animals in the wild. And it also means that everybody working at Blank Park Zoo is doing their own special part to help save animals in the wild. And Ryan, you've heard me talk about Beth a lot. I'm so excited to have Beth Armstrong here on our show today. This is something I've really been looking forward to. Beth is not only the founder of Zoos and Aquariums Committing to Conservation, or the ZAC Conference, as well as Finding Your Voice, Women in Conservation Summit. She is also my mentor. We met in 2011 at Woodland Park Zoo at the ZAC Conference. And that meeting set the stage for Blank Park Zoo to enter into a new phase of helping to save animals in the wild. She has opened many doors for me, introduced me to lots of organizations and people working to save wildlife in lots of different ways. And she's also a very special friend to me as well. And so, Beth, welcome to the show. We're so excited to have you on Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo.
Well, thanks, Jess and Ryan. I really appreciate it. It's a privilege.
So, Beth, let's just talk about your story for a few minutes before we talk about ZAC and Finding Your Voice specifically. What inspired you to be the conservation powerhouse that you are today?
Well, when I first started, I started at the Columbus Zoo volunteering probably around 1980. And eventually I ended up really following my heart, which was to work with great apes and most especially gorillas. And I have to tell you, I felt from the day I walked into that ape house to the day when I left it to start another job at Columbus, I felt a sense of privilege every day. They are absolutely magnificent animals. They taught me a lot about what it means to be human, the way we should comport ourselves in our own daily lives, the gentleness of their parenting skills. And I also, they also, to me, represented very individual stories of how they came to be in captivity or what their life had been like, the highs and the lows, and I felt very strongly that their story needed to be told in some way or another. And I also felt that, just as importantly, that zoos oftentimes were really talking about the animals within their care as ambassadors from the wild, that they were representatives from their cousins in the wild. And, you know, luckily for me, I worked at a zoo, you know, in the 1980s and 90s all the way through the early 2000s, where they believed very strongly in the staff to initiate programs. And I think because I felt like our gorillas in captivity had stories to tell and that we had an obligation to support field work that represented their lives, their cousins in the wild, the zoo was very supportive of us going down that road of becoming a very strong conservation leader starting in 1990. Back in the day, really, where not all zoos, it was even on their radar, truthfully, about thinking about supporting field work. So to me, conservation always comes back down to relationships, my relationship with those gorillas, my feeling and empathy and a wonder at their very being and feeling an obligation to tell their individual stories and then as well tell the stories of their cousins in the wild. That kind of sort of storytelling and sharing, I think is so important for the public to hear, to understand that these animals matter. Of course, we're not just talking about gorillas. We're talking about elephants and dolphins and you know, armadillos, every creature on this earth. They all have a story to tell. And I think I go back to feeling incredibly fortunate that I worked at a zoo that allowed us to tell those stories in a variety of ways. So it's, for me, it started with gorillas, really, and then it sort of morphed out of that in later years.
And that is something that we have in common. My love for great apes and my passion, especially for great ape intelligence, is what drove me to get into a, you know, work to get into a wildlife conservation career. And there's just something that, you know, intangible about great apes. They are just amazing, majestic animals. And I think that our listeners would like to have a little bit of a deeper glimpse into what it was like to spend your days with gorillas. Can you give us kind of a quick story of a day in the life of a gorilla keeper at Columbus?
Yeah, I mean, originally when I first started at Columbus, it was very old school building. They were on constant public display, and it was just sort of a row of barred cages. And I will keep going back to this during this interview, but we were at a zoo that allowed for their keeper staff to be a very vocal proponent and spokespeople for these animals. And we talked to the zoo about when they decided they were going to build a new facility. They allowed us to shut down that facility, renovate it, and have it off exhibit for gorillas. That was unheard of back in the early 1980s. They allowed us to build an exhibit that a lot of people didn't like back in the early 1980s. That was a big cage structure, an outdoor exhibit. But we felt very strongly that gorillas need a three-dimensional exhibit for a lot of different reasons, for their physicality, but also as a way of escaping one another within their troops so that they could make decisions on their daily life. So while when I first began at Columbus, it was not all that pleasant for the animals, but I think in some way that fueled my passion for wanting to make a difference and be a spokesperson for these animals. So the daily care of gorillas, of course, is, you know, you just initially you walk in and you do hand out vitamins, multivitamins and vitamin C, and that's to do a health check to make sure everyone's okay. And there's feeding and cleaning. You shift animals around and you feed and clean and get them back together. Of course, as our exhibit became much more sophisticated and much more interesting places for the gorillas to live and they became much more relaxed, then it was loads of fun to be in that building, to be able to observe gorillas in bigger troops with age diversity from newborn infants to juveniles to blackbacks to silverback male gorillas to a variety of females. You know, I'll tell you a quick story that happened for me. I was about, and again, go back to the days when this was just a row of cages. The gorillas were on constant public display. So when you came in as a new keeper, they, of course, looked at you with a great deal of skepticism. Like, who are you and what are you doing in my private space, which isn't even all that private? So when I would go to feed in the morning when I first started, it was a bit like running a gauntlet. I mean, it was a little scary. They were pretty grabby and they were aggressive and they would sort of gather a little arsenal of carrots and sweet potatoes to throw at me. But I also understood that I stood between them and the public, and they were agitated, as they should have been. And I was about 6 weeks in to working with gorillas, and there was one male gorilla in particular, Bongo, who meant a great deal to me. Very majestic animal, gorgeous males, a silverback male, could put you in your place with one glance, and you were humbled. I mean, I had such a huge degree of respect for him, but everybody did. It wasn't just me. But anyway, he was pretty aggressive towards me when I first started. And one day I came in and I gave him his orange, and I was very cautious. I would stand way back and sort of toss it through the bars. And he came over and he sat down and his face was relaxed and his body language was relaxed, and he did this great vocalization to me, which means everything's good, life is good, how are you? And he tossed his orange back to me. And I thought, uh-oh, is he trying to trick me? Is he trying to get me to come closer so he can grab me? What is he doing? So I very cautiously picked it up and put it back in his cage, watching his body language the whole time. Well, this went back and forth for about 3 or 4 times, and I swear I think he almost did an eye roll, like, oh, my God, don't you get what I'm doing here? And after about the fourth time of him tossing it gently back to me, I realized, oh, my gosh, he wants me to peel it and section it and place it along the bars for him so he can relax and eat his oranges in segments. And it was the most amazing moment and then he let out with this great, wonderful self-satisfied vocalization that only gorillas can do. And I realized I had crossed over, that somehow in his way, he was telling me, okay, you're all right. It's not that we aren't going to have moments, but you have now been accepted into the ape house. And I felt like it was the greatest compliment I had probably ever received in my life.
I love that story. That's an amazing story. And he was like, you finally got it, Beth. It took a few times.
I know. I've written about that story. And I do swear that I think at some point he was kind of like, come on, Beth. What are you not getting about? And then it dawned on me.
And it's also a great story to kind of talk about how we've got, you know, zoo professionals like yourself and others mm-hmm. who have pushed throughout the past, you know, few decades to make sure that all of the animals that we do have inside zoos, you know, aren't on public display all the time. And they've got husbandry training and great vet care and enrichment.
That's right.
And that, you know, now we know what kind of appropriate groups the primates need to be in, and that greater understanding, whether it's, you know, just how they are taken care of at the zoo, and also how they would like to have their oranges peeled. So that is, I love hearing that story.
So, I know.
So tell us what led you.
I mean, I literally was like on cloud nine when I walked back into the ape house kitchen. I was like, oh my gosh, you just accepted me. Yeah.
Tell us.
Well, and I think too, you know, that, I mean, just to say another thing about that gorilla program, again, the very fact that the zoo, Jack Canna, who was the director at the time, he's now a director emeritus, that he listened to the keepers, that he took, when we had a thought or we said, you know what, they have to have time off exhibit. We have to give them a three-dimensional exhibit. Once we had those things in place, those new exhibits, we were then able to completely change, turn upside down gorilla husbandry at the Columbus Zoo by creating age-diversified group through adoption, by having adult males and females adopt infants, whether or not they were related to them or not, back into a gorilla group so that we had infant gorillas being raised by gorillas from a very young age, learning all the proper etiquette, the proper protocols for how you behave in a gorilla troop. The fact that that was all keeper run, that was initiated, and of course we didn't just go off on a tangent. We talked to our curator, we'd have lots of meetings about the protocol of how we proceeded with doing the husbandry, creating we called it the surrogate gorilla group. And it was really an adoptive. They adopted loads and loads and loads of infants into that troop and raised them so that the next generation of gorillas would know how to behave as gorillas and therefore raise their own babies. I think it was a fortunate accident that I was at Columbus at a time where there needed to be great change in the zoo world, and it was absolutely serendipity that I ended up at a zoo that so empowered their staff to be very vocal about how those changes came about. So I have felt forever blessed that I ended up there. It's not only myself, but that my fellow keepers, that we were all on the same page and that we were allowed to brainstorm. I mean, Jesse, it's often what you and I have talked about and our other colleagues in the conservation world. It's the sitting down and talking about where are we at right now and where do we need, and let's take stock, and then where do we need to go and how do we get there? And that's exactly what happened in the Ape House for gorillas. And then eventually that's what happened with our commitment to conservation at the Columbus Zoo starting in the early 1990s.
And that's what I want to talk about next. So tell us how your commitment to changing the lives of gorillas and zoos turned into a commitment for conservation globally and turned into the first zoos and aquariums committing to conservation conference.
Well, with the gorillas, we started funding actually initially a project, and again, another serendipitous situation where I knew somebody who was working in Guatemala, and we ended up hooking up with an NGO down there. This was sometime in 1990, and we ended up giving our first official grant from the Columbus Zoo. I mean, Jack had always been supporting things. When he would go over to Africa, he was doing some rhino and elephant stuff in the 80s, but we didn't really have a set protocol of sort of how to go about it. And we initially gave a small grant. I was still working as a keeper. I worked as a keeper and head keeper of gorillas for years before I ever moved over into our newly formed conservation department. But we started with supporting an NGO, a rescue and rehab facility in Guatemala, and that was just through lucky circumstance that I knew some people there. And then eventually we did some work with Richard Wrangham, who's a chimpanzee primatologist. He's at Harvard University as a professor there. We started working with him in Uganda. And again, absolutely lucky that I was at a primate conference, a chimp conference, and I had a colleague of mine that knew Richard, and she introduced me. And we just started chatting. And I said, Richard, is there anything we can do at the Columbus Zoo to help you with your project? And that's how that partnership started. Then after that, we started working with gorillas at Mbele Bai Gorilla site in New Mbele Ndoki National Park in northern Congo. And that turned out to be a really big turning point for Columbus, because then we started supporting a lot of the ongoing research project and projects and conservation work that New Mbele Ndoki National Park was doing. Elephant research, Stephen Blake was doing work, and then a Bongo Antelope project. And we continued with the gorillas, supporting the gorillas year in and year out, and then the Gualogo Triangle Chimp Project and education programs. All of that sort of builds. And again, Jess, that's what we've talked about. You start with that commitment. There's, you know, our work in Guatemala taught us to sort of approach support for field work, whatever that may be, from a very holistic standpoint. And we also learned to be very humble in our approach, that we were not the field people, that I was not a Guatemalan, I was not from Congo, I was not from Uganda. But we worked with people that were either any one of those, or they had worked in that country for decades, and they understood the local cultures and worked with local communities. And so everything just sort of built upon itself. And so by around 1994, we had kind of a, and we were winging it, I'll be perfectly honest with you. We didn't have a conservation department. I wasn't yet the field conservation coordinator. But I was approaching, we had a committee at the zoo that oversaw our conservation dollars, and I was approaching them a lot to get getting more and more and more support. And in the beginning, a lot of it was for grade 8 conservation field work, because that's my love, and that's what I love to be involved in. But it definitely grew from there to look at any number of different projects. But around 1994, I was over talking to my direct boss, who was the assistant director of the zoo at that time. And Don and I were just sitting around talking, and I said, God, Don, we need a project. And in 1990, we had hosted the first ever guerrilla workshop to bring together field people and zoo people especially to talk about guerrilla husbandry. And again, that came out of the Ape House kitchen, sitting around the kitchen table and saying, we need to do something and bring people together so we can learn from one another. So Don and I were talking about, well, should we do another workshop? And I'll be honest with you, I think Don may have been the one that said, Beth, what if we did conservation? And I'm like, oh, man, that would be great. So, because we were already 4 years into supporting conservation, and we were looking around the zoo world, and we were not seeing a lot of other zoos doing it. WCS, Bronx Zoo, yes, of course, they were doing fabulous work. Busch Gardens, Tampa, SeaWorld, they were doing really good work. So we thought it might be a good idea to bring together people from the zoo world and the field conservation research world so that we could hopefully prompt more zoos to get involved. And we felt that zoos had this enormous role to play because, unlike WWF or Conservation International or the Nature Conservancy, you know, all those big organizations, many of them who are based out of D.C., they have offices you can visit if you know somebody there, but they aren't a place, a destination, where zoos are a place where people bring their families and they come and spend the day or have memberships. And so that zoos had this amazing role that they were not fulfilling of sort of being the window, literally into the wild, into telling the stories of the people that were working in the field. And we just, definitely in 1994, we were not seeing that in the zoo world. So our thought with having the first Zoos and Aquariums Committing to Conservation Conference, which is called ZAC, in 1995, was that it was our attempt to shift the culture of zoos. It was the same philosophy we were doing with guerrilla husbandry. How do we make the change within the zoo world? How do we present examples and models so that there isn't a zoo out there that can say, oh, we can't afford to do that. We could show them ways that they could do it, that there was no reason why they couldn't be supporting field work. And from our experience, just the 4 short years that we were doing a lot of conservation work at Columbus from 90 to 94, we found that the field people were just like looking for support and needed, of course, the support. So that was our thought when we hosted the first ZAC conference in 1995. And I remember about 6 weeks before the conference, we didn't have a whole lot of people signed up, and I was pretty worried. And I talked to my boss, Don Winstall, and thank God for Don for having the wisdom. He just said, Beth, how many people are signed up? I said, oh, Don, it's about 40. And he said, well, that's 40 more people that are talking about conservation that weren't talking about it before. Now, 6 weeks later, we were perfectly fine. We had over 200 people. But I love the fact that I worked at an institution that my immediate boss was like, let's just do it. Let's not doubt ourselves. We know we're on the right track. Let's just do it. And from that first conference in 1995, then we went on to look for hosts every 2 years that would be willing to take on that task. So in 1997, Busch Gardens Tampa did it, 1999, San Diego. I had moved to the Brevard Zoo in 2001, and we took over, did ZAC for two years running. We did it in super early 2001, and then we did it in super late 2004, I think, or something like that. Houston Zoo has been a host, Blank Park Zoo, Woodland Park, Denver Zoo, Jacksonville Zoo, and it continues to be a forum of trying to be helpful, to bring the right people in the room so that the sparks start to fly and people start to connect. And the philosophy is pretty basic. We kind of look at it like we're holding a really nice dinner party, that we want the atmosphere to feel great. We want everyone to feel welcome, that their voices are welcome, and that they feel special when they're there. So that, once again, when you're standing in line for lunch, you may be standing in front of somebody from the field that you were inspired by the talk they gave earlier that day, and all of a sudden you start talking to them, and all of a sudden by the end of the day, a partnership has begun. And that's really what ZAC is all about.
And that's exactly right. That has been my experiences at ZAC as well, as you just sit down at a table with zoos from all over the country, all over the world, field people from all over the world, and you figure out ways to deepen that partnership. What can zoos do? Well, we can fund field organizations, but we can also add capacity through helping them with some of their projects like graphic design and making videos and sending supplies and things like that. There's so much to talk about, Beth. We're almost out of time. So I want us to do is to talk about finding your voice during another podcast. And tell us, before we sign off today, where can we find more information about ZAC? And we have a ZAC conference coming up in 2020. And tell us just quickly about that conference and how people can find out more information.
Okay, in June of 2020, the Utah's Hogle Zoo and the Tracy Aviary in Salt Lake City will be hosting the next ZAC. If you go to www.zaccconference.com, that's our website, and then you can also go to ZAC Conference, the Facebook page, and that's actually even better because I have a tendency to post more frequently on that, and also just post in general, a lot of really cool conservation work that's going on around the world.
Beth, thank you so much for joining us today. And on our next podcast with Beth Armstrong, we're going to talk about some specific examples of partnerships that have formed through the ZAC conferences over the years, as well as talk about Finding Your Voice Women in Conservation Summit. Thank you, Beth, for so many years of guidance and for all that you do for conservation.
Oh, thanks, Jess. Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you for joining us today, and we're just about out of time. If you want to learn more about Blank Park Zoo and our conservation programs and our events, go over to blankparkzoo.com and make sure you check out all the fun videos we have up on our YouTube page. We'll see you next time on Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo.